Hi, and welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show here on 102.7 FM Co-op Radio, CFRO, in Vancouver, unceded Coast Salish Territories, Canada. Today is Friday, August 10th, 2012. I'm your host, Alon Cohen, and I'm joined here with my co-host, Alyssa Ray.
Hello.
And also Kelly, who's filling in for Allison for the controls. Thank you, Kelly. Animal Voices is Vancouver's and Western Canada's only animal advocacy and vegan radio program, bringing you all the animal and vegan-related news, events, interviews, lifestyle, and commentary you need to keep up to date on what's happening both locally and internationally. We here at Animal Voices encourage a movement toward a world in which all animals, both human and non-human, are treated with compassion and care. We strive to expose all the complicated relationships we share with all the critters of this planet and wish that all animals be able to flourish to their full potential. This program can be heard every Friday from noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time and is also streamed live at coopradio.org and also available on iTunes and animalvoices.org after airing. So today is August 10th and it's Prison Justice Day, so I'm pretty excited about that. There'll be a memorial rally in March, which will be at 6 p.m. tonight at Trout Lake Park, that's in East Vancouver, of course in BC. Speakers will include ex-prisoners and anti-prison activists. It's being organized by the Prison Justice Day Committee, that's PJD. PJD at prisonjustice.ca if you want to send them an email, and you can actually find them at prisonjustice.ca. And Prison Justice Day is a day to remember all the men, women, and youth who have died in prison. So of course, what does all this have to do with animals? Well, Andy Stepanian, who was one of the members of the Shack 7, and for those of you who don't know what the Shack 7 were or are, they were a group of people who were convicted on the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act in the US on charges for campaigning to shut down a notorious animal testing lab known as Huntington Life Sciences. And so after coming out of prison, he said, "I oppose the prison industrial complex in all forms of oppression. I don't relish seeing a single piece of kindling thrown into the fire, no matter how despicable the animal abusing wretch is. I think we need to get proactive in healing our culture's illnesses, and in turn these abusers, whom I see as symptomatic, will be a less frequent phenomenon." So with all that in mind, we're going to be doing a whole show today on prison justice and its interrelation with animal rights and animals. So on today's show, we'll be talking to Professor Kim Socha from Normandale Community College in Bloomington, Minnesota. Kim is a director with the Institute for Critical Animal Studies, which is a fantastic institute, and she's just released a new book called Women, Destruction, and the Avant-Garde, A Paradigm for Animal Liberation, which is part of the Critical Animal Studies series at Radobi Press. We'll be chatting with her about the intersections between the prison system and animals and why it is that those of us who care about animals should also be caring about prisoners and the prison system. Next, we'll also be chatting with Tony Humphreys, who works with the Animal Liberation Front Supporters Group. For those of you who don't know the infamous Animal Liberation Front, or the ALF, or ALF for short, it's an international underground leaderless resistance that engages in illegal direct action in pursuit of animal liberation. Activists see themselves as modern-day underground railroad activists, removing animals from laboratories and farms, destroying facilities, arranging safe houses and veterinary care, and operating sanctuaries where the animals live out the rest of their lives. So we'll be chatting with Tony today, and he'll be joining us from England with the Animal Liberation Front Supporters Group, which is not part of the ALF, of course, because ALF is an underground movement. Rather, the supporters group exists to support animal rights activists who are unfortunate enough to end up behind bars and promote an understanding of the reasons why decent, caring people feel forced to break the law in regards to creating animal liberation or pursuing the motions of animal liberation. So, of course, they are separate from the ALF, and they operate legally and above ground. So we'll be chatting with Tony about what it means to be vegan and prison, what the prisoners suffer in the conditions of a prison system, and why prison solidarity is an important action that we ought to be engaging in as people who care for animals. So you're listening to the Animal Voices Radio Show here on 102.7 FM Co-op Radio, CFRO. So there's one thing I wanted to chat about quickly. I was actually at a festival just last week at Artswells, which is a fantastic festival. And I think you were at a festival as well, Alyssa.
Yeah, I was at Base Coast in Squamish at the Squamish Valley Campground. It was beautiful. I hope you had an amazing time on your weekend. I sure did. Bass Coast is electronic music. It was a 3-day festival, and last year, I remember, we talked a little bit about festival fashion, which is kind of a hard to ignore. It's a lot of a fashion show, especially at these kind of festivals. I'm not sure about you.
So the one thing that I saw, and maybe you can want to chat about, I saw quite common at this festival is a lot of people wearing foxtails on their outfits, and I wasn't quite sure what it was. I spoke to some people. Some people think it has to do with a culture of roadkill, so people who eat roadkill and then wear the tails on them. But, of course, a lot of people bind them. I'm not sure if it's part of a punk scene or a raver scene. I don't know how you feel about this.
I'm not sure where it originated. I think it's I think it just came about sort of in the raver festival culture. I definitely saw a bunch of them where I was, and they were for sale there as well. I think they were like $40 or something for a real foxtail. I kind of regret not like asking the vendors where they got them from, and I didn't want to quite put anyone on the spot and ask them about the ethics of them, but it almost seemed like, I don't know, like I just wondered how people can justify this. It seemed like people think that maybe they just lose their tails, like they shed them or something, and they just found them in the forest, lying on the ground. Super, super weird. It reminds me of just like, I don't know, having a child's hand like attached to you as a token, or I don't know. I thought it was very disturbing, and I think it kind of, there is also a lot of fake fur and faux fur and those kind of you have like ear headed hoods with them to be sort of like your animal spirit. They call them spirit hoods. So I think it kind of comes from that, like just wanting to be the spirit of the animal and be, I don't know, mischievous like a fox or something, be close to nature. I can kind of, you know, respect where that's coming from, but I don't think people are connected with the realities. Of course, I think most of these foxtails come from fur farms. Very likely that the foxes lived in tiny cages their entire lives and then were probably anally electrocuted and killed just for that little piece of their fur. I just think that most people just have no idea, and I really would like to educate more people about where they actually come from. Maybe people justify it thinking that they're vintage or something, or I had never heard the roadkill thing myself, but it just kind of boggles my mind. There's also, of course, the feathers everywhere. There's feather headdresses, sort of, which I find really not politically correct, like with neon feathers and people, I don't know, just kind of dressing up in so-called like Aboriginal garb to party. It's very disturbing, and cruel to animals, of course, as well, because these craft feathers don't generally come from friendly places, although there are some sources of cruelty-free dropped feathers from sanctuaries, and you know, you can't tell by looking at them, but yeah, they're just for sale everywhere, these feather earrings, feather attachments to outfits and such, and yeah, I just find it all very, very disturbing. But you know, you don't want to like put anyone on the spot and make anyone feel like evil or something, like, yeah, or just, I don't know how to have those conversations, and I'd like to learn how to have them better and stand strong and just educate people, but without making them feel like they're bad or what they do is bad. So that's about all I have to say about that. I really hope that this is a fad that just passes, but the only way I guess that'll do that is if through sort of more public education about fur. So, that's about all I have to say. Any additional comments, Elon?
No, that's it. And I think with that in mind, we can actually move to our interview. We have on the line with us Kim Socha. She's a professor at Normandale Community College of English Studies. Hi, Kim. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. Thank you for having me on.
Great. So, of course, one of the things you do is that you are on the board and a director with the Institute for Critical Animal Studies. Can you tell us a bit about this institute?
Sure. It was ICAST, as I'll refer to it. It was founded in 2001 to promote the interdisciplinary field of critical animal studies. And that field is dedicated to the cessation of non-human animal, human animal, and ecological exploitation. It's the mission of the Institute is to look at oppression holistically from a political perspective as opposed to the apolitical approach that some academic fields take. We look at oppression from a global perspective, factoring issues of environmental and human exploitation as we consider the ways in which non-human animals are positioned as non-agential beings in contemporary culture. But despite the focus on the academy and this being like an academic field, it's also, ICAST is also an activist resource. So it's for activists and academics that seeks ways to put theory into praxis. So it's not just about writing theory, it's about how can these ideas be implemented in the so-called real world as well.
Great. And I think, you know, and it really is fantastic that the Institute, of course, is bridging the gap between the activist community and academics. There's something, a gap that we see that needs to obviously be bridged. And so one of the things that ICAST has done that I'm super glad about, and very timely given the fact that today is Prison Justice Day, they just released a special issue on their journal, the Journal for Critical Animal Studies, on prisons and animals. And of course, many people see the prison system as something good, as something natural, as something normal that we need in our society, as something that, of course, keeps bad people away from us and keep us safe. So can you explain exactly what do you believe that to be wrong with the prison system and prisons in general?
Okay. I like that terminology you use because the prison system, much like, if I can make that comparison, human use of non-human animals is seen as natural and normal. As a way of putting people, and when I say people, I mean non-human animals as well, in their proper place. For example, criminals belong behind bars instead of the animals before we wear them, eat them, or experiment on them. The latest issue of the Journal for Critical Animal Studies, which just as a little plug, is available online for free. You know, people don't have to pay an access fee to read it, critiques the supposed normalcy of such institutions, the non-human animal imprisonment and human animal. As to the prison system itself, at least in the United States, which is where I'm coming from, it's become an economic system that's reliant upon bodies to fill beds and provide cheap labor for large corporations. For the sake of time, I mean, if you wanted to do a follow-up, that's great. I'm going to defer the broad issue of prison abolition because I want to focus on the here and now of the problem with prisons. And as I and many others see things, and again, this is specifically an American issue. War on drugs was instituted to assure a constant influx of bodies to meet the financial needs of an increasingly privatized prison system. So your listeners or you may be familiar with a book called The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander. And she notes that since the war on drugs was declared in the 1980s under Reagan's presidency, the prison system has grown from housing 300,000 to more than 2 million individuals, with African Americans making up the bulk of the U.S. prison system and drug-related charges accounting for two-thirds of the inmate population. The problem with prisons, therefore, is that they spring from a fundamentally racist and classist social structure, with, at this point, if you're thinking 2 million people, there's little to no focus on rehabilitation. Rather, they are human warehouses that feed the American economy. The short answer, therefore, is that prisons are a business. And with that truth comes the further reality, and it should be a scary reality, that those in power, so to speak, need to keep making more prisoners. And the way to do that is to have a war on drugs, because they account for so much of the prison population and incarcerations.
So with that in mind, of course, if we need to be focusing on rehabilitation, and you argue that, of course, prisons don't actually provide avenues for people to reform or to reintegrate into communities, how exactly do you see communities should be focusing on efforts for restorative justice and actually essentially reorganizing or putting people that do bad acts or acts that are against community standards back into the community in such a way that nobody's, of course, ostracized?
Do you mean how do we accomplish that?
Yeah. And I wonder if I wonder if on this line you can actually maybe tell us exactly about the projects that you are involved in, the Minnesota Circles of Support and Accountability, and also the Twin Cities Save the Kids project. So it seems to me that these projects actually push away from this more state-centric model of punishment.
Right, and I think that can begin to answer your question. And the thing is that they're small movements. So I'm first going to talk about Minnesota Circles of Support and Accountability. Now, that's a restorative justice program, and it is aligned with the Department of Corrections, and I do some work with them, although they are, you know, a government-sponsored organization. Save the Kids is actually a national transformative justice program, so I'm going to explain a little bit the difference between restorative and transformative, though I do want to pose them both as viable options for the current prison system. MNCOSA, which is Minnesota Circles of Support and Accountability, works with recently paroled sex offenders and goes beyond mere punishment of the offender to work with him or her, though I may use the pronoun he more regularly because sexual offenders are predominantly male, so that the community into which he is released will be safer. Thus, past and potential victims of the sexual offender are also considered as he is paroled. So that's what I do with MNCOSA. I, along with other community members, form a little network, and we meet with paroled sex offenders so that they both consistently take accountability for past actions and do not reoffend. So there's this sense of not only helping the individual who has been through the criminal justice system, but helping that community stay safe. The program is being piloted in the U.S., at least in Minnesota. It has been very successful in Canada as far as lowering recidivism rates of sexual offenses. Now, I will say that the critics of restorative justice may note that it's been integrated into the prison system itself. So, as I said, I work with this program, but through the Minnesota Department of Corrections. So some people might have, like, you're working with the very system that's causing the problem. But it's a valid critique. It has also been seen to re-victimize those who have been subjected to sexual, physical, or emotional violence, almost like forcing them to go through what's happened in the past rather than focusing on the future. So I want to take a moment to talk about another alternative, which is transformative justice. Some people see it as a more efficient model than restorative. It looks more deeply into the social system that creates the offender-victim dichotomy in the first place, considering ways in which offenders themselves are victims of or have been victims of racism, classism, adultism, ableism, and so on. Transformative justice doesn't just wish to restore justice because the justice system itself is broken, so why do we want to go back to that? Rather, it's forward-looking, considering the ways in which the offender-victim and the system itself may be changed to meet the needs of, rather than continue to oppress the community. So another organization I do work with is Save the Kids. It's a national organization with chapters springing up all over the country that believes that no child should ever be incarcerated. And we bring that message into juvenile detention facilities and prisons on a weekly basis, offering group building activities and mentoring programs that will allow children to transform their lives both within and once they're out of incarceration, as opposed to simply returning them to the same subjugated communities that set them up for incarceration in the first place. So those are the two ways that I work within the prison system, and there are nuanced differences between the approaches that I think people should be aware of as well.
Great. So, of course, with that in mind, let's actually return back to the topic of real prisoners' lives. And if we see many shows, I'm thinking of shows on Discovery Channel, for instance, on Animal Planet, that actually show animals being integrated with prisoners as forms of rehabilitation and forms of, I guess one could say, restorative justice, or forms of to reintegrate them back into the community, change their psychically, psychologically. So I wonder if you can actually chat about exactly how do prisoners come to interact with animals, and how do prisons function as a space where they, perhaps the non-human-human binary may somewhat collapse, or perhaps, in fact, the opposite may happen and may become even more stark?
I find all of any use of non-human animals, I mean, in general, problematic. But so, as you had mentioned, prisoners interact with non-human animals in a number of ways. For example, dogs may be used as therapeutic tools. And again, I want to emphasize that word tools, and this is where the problem comes in which prisoners interact with canines to establish a relationship and maybe develop emotional bonds. I mean, this is problematic in its own right, in the same way that, you know, so-called therapy animals, and even animals as pets, is problematic. Because in all of these situations, what we have is, a non-human animal being used as a means to a human end. And, it's hard to unpack all of these issues. They're loaded issues, especially that with even just having, I share my home with a dog. So, you know, there could be problems therein as well. So I think that's inherently problematic as far as a way to, like, animals become, again, I'll use that word, tools, as a way to restore humans to their humanity. And then, animals are used as food, as sustenance. I think any use of non-human animals to meet human ends is inherently problematic. And then some of the other programs that are used in the have actually combined. I had before talked about the prison industrial complex, prison as a business. And then there are these new programs that combine the prison and animal industrial complexes in what I think is a very disturbing way. While the programs might be promoted as reformative and restorative, in truth, I think they're once again mere examples of using prisoners as free labor beyond upkeep costs. And here I'm talking about using prisoners to work on dairy farms, using prisoners to work in slaughterhouses. So prisoners become free labor, just like they're making underwear for Victoria's Secret, or putting pieces together for Microsoft, or to build a computer. In much the same way, non-human animals are free labor and free parts beyond upkeep costs. So I think I don't know if that dichotomy collapses as much as it continues, but it also kind of meshes in this very odd way with the use of prisoners working in slaughterhouses.
I actually wanted to, maybe if we can touch more on that topic, more specifically, because of course there are many programs in the U.S. and Canada where prisoners are involved in slaughterhouses, but these programs are promoted as rehabilitation programs to reintegrate them into society. So I wonder if you can actually talk about specifically that connection where prisoners are actually used as free labor within slaughterhouses on the subject of rehabilitation.
Absolutely. Again, I'm not a psychologist, but I'll say that, as people know, slaughterhouses are notorious for their high turnover rates as far as employment goes. As it is, it's psychologically damaging to be faced with such violence on a day-to-day basis. So there's a lot of turnover. People leave slaughterhouse work. But on the other side, slaughterhouse workers are also known to become desensitized to animal suffering when working under such conditions. We've seen the images, we know the stories of just egregious animal abuse, beyond the abuse that is typical in the housing and slaughter of non-human animals. We see, there was a recent story about Tyson Foods and, Kentucky Fried Chicken, these kind of extra forms of abuse that goes on because working in that kind of environment, people become desensitized to suffering. And once again, both the prison and animal industrial complexes are inherently exploitive. And with little to no rehabilitation taking place in prisons, I simply cannot imagine how working in a slaughterhouse could ever allow incarcerated individuals to transform. Rather, it seems just another means by which prisoners may become desensitized to violence and more apt to commit acts of violence once they are released into the community. so, and having talked to prisoners, I know the stories of, you know, the so-called old-timers will tell stories of, you know, a young man comes into prison for a, you know, a marijuana bust and comes out much more hardened and violent than when he first came in because of what he experienced in prison. So to then put somebody in a slaughterhouse and think that somehow they're going to transform, I don't know if that means become more sensitive, reformed individuals, just seems impossible and honestly just as kind of a ruse or a way to get prisoners, again, to act as free labor or cheap labor within the animal industrial complex.
So with that in mind, given the fact how we treat animals or non-human animals within the animal industrial industry, is it fair to say that prisons and the way that current society actually constructs prisons and uses prisoners as free labor, as bodies that we can do what we will with them, is it fair to say that we turn them prisoners into, turn human prisoners into non-mere animals such that they don't exist beyond mere animal functionality?
I think that's a very interesting way of looking at it. I mean, I wouldn't use those terms necessarily because, you know, it's always, I've been using the term animal as well, but I believe, of course, that humans are animals. But in the way that being animal is looked at negatively in society, I think absolutely, yes, it's fair to say that prisons, much like animal industries, take away the individual's sense of self and any right to personhood. So that is the main way that we animalize humans, although, again, humans still being animals. However, I don't like making this comparison lightly. You know, I imagine maybe you have an audience that's already sensitive to issues of non-human animals, but like kind of like the average person is highly offended whenever humans are compared to non-human animals. So I just wanted to note that it's not something that that I say too lightly. Non-human animals are also born into prisons, literally. And, you know, while a metaphor may be found therein, as those born into certain communities are also born into a system that sets them up for imprisonment, the bars, at least for a while, remain figurative. So this is not true for non-humans. So I think there are absolutely analogies to be made there, but there also the distinction needs to be kept separate. And part of the reason I even maybe sound hesitant is I am not saying, well, humans choose whether or not they want to go to prison, and non-human animals don't get that choice. I think cultural conditions set people up for imprisonment. And these are cultural conditions that take away the individual's sense of self and personhood before they even arrive in the prison system. So I think the correlation is fair.
So it seems to be, of course, the fact that there seems to be obviously a very clear metaphor between the cages that in which prisons sit in and the cages that in which non-human animals live their lives. And of course, you point this out. Of course, this is a metaphor we need to make lightly. But on that same line, there are many animal advocacy organizations that call for stricter penalties and harsher punishments for animal cruelty. So what exactly do you see as being the overlap between the conditions of prisons and that of animals, such that those of us who care about animals ought to actually care about prisoners themselves? And I guess we should say, actually, we should be advocating not so much for harsher penalties, harsher prison sentences for animal cruelty, but we should be doing other forms of restorative or transformative justice.
Right. This is a very difficult question for me to answer. You know, it's a difficult issue for me, but I'll do my best. As someone who's critical of the prison-industrial complex, I struggle with saying that the law will solve the problem of animal cruelty. In fact, I will say it will not solve the problem of animal cruelty. And again, mentioning the latest issue of the Journal for Critical Animal Studies, Anthony Nocella has a piece that addresses these very issues, noting that animal advocates should be against the punishment and imprisonment of animal abusers in favor of a more transformative approach to ending animal cruelty. My gut reaction, I admit, when I hear of animal abuse is just vengeance, pure vengeance. That's my initial reaction. Punish the abuser in the most vicious way possible and lock him or her up for life. But I have to go beyond that initial gut reaction because it negates the need to look at a society that is founded upon animal cruelty. So this question also struck me because your average person will be shocked and horrified when they read of domestic animal abuse. So, you know, a dog is abused or a cat, but see no problem in wearing animals, eating them, and using products that have been tested on them. When animal abuse occurs, I think activists need to become much more critical. Use the opportunity, not that, you know, I wish these opportunities never arose, but use the opportunity to expose the ways in which that act of abuse is endemic to our culture, and that there is inherent hypocrisy in opposing one form of abuse, but tacitly taking part in others on a daily and sometimes hourly basis, meaning horrified when a dog fighting ring is exposed, but, you know, eating a standard diet of meat and dairy. Those animals' lives are horrific, and that just gets lost. Animal advocates, therefore, I think, must become literate in the problems with prisons and how their very existence as punitive institutions allows for a culture that sees non-human animals as disposable products and bodies to do with as we please. What do we do about it, though? I would love to see animal advocates develop transformative justice programs with animal abusers in the ways that I described with Minkosa, and even more so Save the Kids. Work with these people, you know, don't shun them. In truth, if I believed for one moment that locking someone up for 1 month or 1 year will transform that person into one who values the lives of non-human animals, I would support it. But in reality, I don't believe it works. Rather, that person may very well come out more angry and violent than when he or she went in. Penalties and punishment are not the answer. I wish it was that simple. Rather, accountability and transformation offers the most promise for a world in which animal abuse can be most adequately addressed. I mean, I wish I had a better answer than I don't believe prisons work, but as it stands, I truly don't believe that that would be the answer.
I think as you've given it, I think that's been a great answer. And with that in mind, we're out of time. So thanks so much for being with us, Kim. Super, super great. And of course, you do have a new book out entitled Women, Destruction and the Avant-Garde, A Paradigm for Animal Liberation. We'll be linking this to our website. So for those of you interested in the work that Kim's been doing, you can definitely check this out. So thanks so much, Kim, for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Take care. Bye now.
Thank you. Bye.
Well, it made big news this week. On Monday, Kavna, a 46-year-old beluga, died at the Vancouver Aquarium, otherwise known as Vancouver's Whale Jail. This morning, officials announced the necropsy results indicated that the likely cause of her death was cancer in her reproductive tract. She had been reportedly healthy throughout her life, but she appeared to have been declining over recent weeks. The aquarium said that Kavna had lived a long life, considering that in the wild, the white whale is believed to live about 25 to 30 years old. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, however, says that longevity for belugas in the wild is 35 to 50 years, so it's not quite the miracle that they're sort of touting. The name Kavna is Inuktitut Nitsilik Igloolik and means female spirit of the deep, or the one down there, and refers to the Inuit legend of the mother of sea mammals. She inspired the song Baby Beluga by children's entertainer Raffi. He went to visit her at the aquarium in 1979, and his song goes, "Baby Beluga in the deep blue sea, swim so wild, you swim so free, heaven above and the sea below, and a little white whale on the go." Of course, the irony is that for 37 years, Kavna did not swim in the deep blue sea, nor did she swim free. She lived in captivity in a tiny enclosure in the Vancouver Aquarium. She was captured off the coast of Manitoba in the Churchill River on July 25, 1976. How were whales caught back then? Well, boats would herd a single beluga into shallow water. A diver would jump into the water and then attempt to lasso the whale. The diver would sometimes ride on the back of the whale while attempting to fix the rope over her head. When she was captured, she was pregnant on July 13th, 1977. She delivered a live calf. who the aquarium named Tuak. He was the first beluga to be born at the aquarium. He was less than 4 months old when he died on November 2nd, 1977. Currently, there are two belugas, a mother-daughter pair, who are still at the Vancouver site. The aquarium reportedly has plans to purchase another male beluga after construction of the new Arctic enclosure is completed in 2016. Efforts are ramping up to put pressure on the aquarium to end the beluga enclosure for good. The real reason the Vancouver Aquarium keeps these highly intelligent marine mammals in captivity is not education or conservation, but money. Please write the Vancouver Park Board Commissioners, PB Comment at city.vancouver.bc.ca, and urge them to stop the expansion of whale tanks in Stanley Park.
Hey, did you hear about the Vancouver Co-op radio frequency change?
Yeah, the singer does have a great range.
No, the change.
Their music's pretty progressive, but I wouldn't call it strange.
No, the Vancouver Co-op radio frequency change. They're moving to the 100.5 FM frequency on September 10th. They'll still have the same local, passionate, community-made programming, but their signal will be stronger and in stereo at 100.5 FM.
Oh, cool. I think I need to move away from the speakers. I can't hear anything you're saying.
What?
Exactly.
For more info about the Vancouver Co-op Radio frequency change, please visit coopradio.org.
It's the summer book sale this weekend at Spartacus Books. Today, Friday, August 10th, until closing on Sunday, August 12th, 10% off new titles, 25% off used titles. Free kids books, a wide selection of cheap dollar and $2 titles. They're open tonight, that's Friday, until 8:30, and every weekday. Saturdays, 11 a.m. till 7 p.m., and Sundays, noon until 7. Spartacus Books is a nonprofit, volunteer-run bookstore and resource center located on the edge of Vancouver's downtown east side at 684 East Hastings Street. Spartacus is the go-to resource for anti-capitalist political books not found in big box stores. They have an unparalleled selection of academic and scholarly publications, including journals and books from hard-to-find publishers that aren't available anywhere else in the city. They also have a great selection of graphic novels, magazines, and they carry a huge selection of nowhere-else-to-be-found zines by local and non-local activists, poets, and writers. They also sell patches, badges, t-shirts, and posters, and they also host events. So check that out this weekend. Coming up later in September, it is time to start fundraising for this year's Walk for Farm Animals. It's happening Saturday, September 29th at 10 a.m. till 2 at the Vancouver Art Gallery, downtown Vancouver. It's the 6th annual Walk for Farm Animals in Vancouver, and Liberation BC is hosting it. It's time to register. Last year, Vancouver was the top Canadian fundraiser, and we can definitely do it again, but we need to get started and get fundraising. So if you want more information, I think you can check out Liberation BC's website, or you can email vancouver@walkforfarmanimals.org. If you have events you'd like us to share on the show, please get in touch, radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. And I think that's, I might have something else, but I don't actually think I do. But I do have actually another short little news story. The USDA actually revealed how they posted about Meatless Monday, and then it was retracted in their newsletter. So that kind of made news last week, and now the USDA has made a statement that they said that it was never approved, and they had to apologize to the National Cattlemen's Beef Association for promoting Meatless Mondays in the newsletter. They revealed that it was a mistake, and they said two engineers who were responsible for making the organization greener became overzealous and decided to promote Meatless Monday, even though the endorsement was never approved. So, of course, Meatless Mondays are related to, yeah, all the terrible effects of animal agriculture. And that was a kind of a funny slip-up. I wonder how much trouble those two people got in for releasing that in the newsletter. I did actually see another little clip in the news this week about a study. It said that women suffering from eating disorders are 4 times more likely to be vegetarian than women without eating disorders. And that was published in the Journal of the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. The researchers found that 52% of women with a history of eating disorders had been vegetarians at some point in their lives. In contrast, only 12% of women without eating disorders had experimented with a vegetarian diet. They're kind of just saying that vegetarianism can be a symptom of an eating disorder. Of course, there's a lot of amazing reasons to be vegan and vegetarian, and people generally accept that sort of without question. But I think a dietitian in the article who works with young people with eating disorders said that it's really important that clinicians and people who are concerned about other people with potential eating disorders should really question the reasoning behind. Often, if the reasoning behind going veg is weight loss, that can possibly be a red flag for eating disorders. So, it's important to know where people are coming from, because, of course, when you are vegan, you are restricting, quote unquote, I guess. I don't feel I'm restricting anything. I'm opening up my life and my heart and my choices, but a lot of people see it as restriction, and therefore it sort of appeals to people as sort of another excuse to keep things off the table. And the dietitian who works with people with eating disorders said that it can sort of fall into this category of what's called orthorexia, which is an obsession with healthy eating, and that can sort of cover, that can be a kind of eating disorder. She pointed out that only 5% of those who fully recovered from their eating disorder were still vegetarians. Well, I guess that's kind of sad. But anyway, and I guess that's all I have for the news today. On to our next interview.
Great. Well, unfortunately, we couldn't get a hold of Tony in England with the ELF supporters group. But we definitely have a really, really awesome speaker. We have with us on the line Sue Brown. Sue is actually speaking today at 6 p.m. at the Prison Justice Day Memorial Rally. She's actually working with Justice for Girls. And she'll be speaking today. And she is actually herself an animal rights activist. So she connects both the animal rights advocacy work and prison justice works in her own kind of orientation. So hi, Sue.
Hi.
Hi, great. Thanks for being on the phone with us, especially since we couldn't get Tony on the line.
My pleasure.
Yeah, so of course, so you're speaking today at Prison Justice Day. Can you actually chat us, can you tell us a bit about what Prison Justice Day is and what's going on today at 6 p.m. at Trout Lake Park, and what it is that the work that you're doing with Justice for Girls?
Okay, so Prison Justice Day is a day that it's been going on for about 30 years now, and it's a day to remember prisoners who have died in prisons in Canada and around the world. It's a day to sort of stand in solidarity and recognize the violence of prison and speak out about the injustice of prison. So it started after a prison riot in 1976 when a number of prisoners were killed, and it's been sort of an ongoing annual tradition. I myself haven't been included or involved in organizing it, but I've spoken at it in the past, and I'm looking forward to speaking at it again this evening. So basically, it's a bunch of activists who come together from all areas of activism around prison justice. So there's people who will be speaking about immigration and prisons. There's people who will be speaking about conditions in solitary confinement, and people who will be talking about activism and other activist strategies around prison justice day. And there will also be sort of a number of other speakers speaking about people who have died in prison and remembering people who are in prison. It's a really important day. It's the only day that we really set aside to talk about this issue, and I think too often all of us activists are too silent on this issue. So really looking forward to speaking out this evening, and I hope that if people are available, if they want to come out, it's at the southeast end of Trout Lake Park at the Claire Culhane Memorial Bench.
Great. And what is and you work with Justice for Girls. Can you tell us a bit about the organization that you do work for them?
Yeah, I don't work for them anymore. I still do work with them. And the work that we do primarily is around advocacy for girls who live in poverty. And the aspect that I've focused on in my work has been on prison justice work and prison advocacy for girls in custody. So a lot of what I've done is focused on campaigns around trying to end strip searching and trying to end solitary confinement in youth prisons in BC and in Canada, as well as advocating for girls' human rights as they're articulated in the Convention of the Rights of the Child around conditions of imprisonment and such for youth. I've also did research on conditions in police holding cells and human rights abuses against girls by police.
Great. So I actually have I know this is in your area of expertise, specifically surrounding eco-terrorism and the animal rights movement, but we have John Lewis, who's actually a top FBI official, was quoted a couple years ago saying that the number one domestic terrorism threat is eco-terrorism and the animal rights movement. And it seems to me that the criminal justice system is almost, in a certain way, specifically targeting and wreaking havoc on the hearts and minds of people fighting for change for the animals. Have you found in the work that you do around prison justice and prison abolition that there has been over the years kind of a harder and starker push back against people who do work on animals and on the environmental movement?
I can't say that from Justice for Girls' perspective, but I certainly, in my own experience as an activist and having sort of witnessed a number of moves by the government to silence dissent, I think that animal rights and environmental activism has certainly sort of been constructed as sort of a folk devil, moral panic type issue. And I think that I think the government is fearful, and I think that any sort of sense that there may be some kind of uprising or some kind of movement building leads them to clamp down really hard on animal rights activists. I think because animal rights and environmental activism get to sort of the heart of what's really wrong with capitalism and with the system of oppression that we're currently living in, I think that it offers the strongest critique and the most dangerous critique to the government. And so it's met with harsh resistance from the government, and the criminal justice system has always operated as a system for silencing opposition to the government and to sort of state policies and status quo. So they have a strident interest in protecting that. So in answer to your question, yes, I have seen very harsh treatment of animal rights and environmental activists, very disproportionate to the actions that they've done, particularly, I mean, from
definitely
my own
yeah
biased perspective.
Yeah, of course. So if we can actually chat a bit about, you know, I don't want to generalize prison conditions across North America, because of course they differ in intensity and extremity, but I wonder if you can tell us a bit about, in kind of an almost in a general way, I mean, if you want to point out the particularities of certain prison systems as being particularly harsh, you can do so, but can you tell us about the conditions that prisoners face in jail cells and in solitary confinement and in these really harsh conditions?
Yeah, I mean, prisons are dangerous places. They're cold, they're dark, they're institutional looking. For those of us in Vancouver, if you've ever been to Simon Fraser University, it's similar looking. That was a bit of a joke. Prisons are, they're dangerous, first of all. There's a lot of violence in prison that's meted out both by prisoners as well as prison guards. There isn't sort of any safe area that a prisoner can go to sort of seek refuge or protect themselves. So often when people end up in prison, first they have to sort of shed any essence of themselves and sort of conform to the code of prison, whatever that may be. And that in itself is a psychological and emotionally sort of damaging practice. And there's a lot of sort of routines and structures in prison that are designed to denigrate and indignify people who go into prison. So the fact that prisoners are strip searched routinely, for example, the fact that prisoners are forced into sort of a regimented system of engaging in daily activities such as eating, and they're restricted in when they can go outside, and that's all designed to strip away the soul, to basically force prisoners to conform. So it's very harsh psychologically, and of course coercive. In terms of sort of food, food is not, well, I think we'll talk about that a little bit more, but food is generally not good, and quality is not healthy food. So the health of prisoners is often deteriorating, and they don't have adequate access to medical care. So that's an obviously combined issue. Among some of the other human rights abuses that I've heard, I mean, solitary confinement is one of the worst. I would urge people, if you're interested in learning more, to read the report of the Special Rapporteur on Torture for the UN, who released a report last year discussing the psychological and emotional impact and physical impact of solitary confinement, and basically deems it a form of torture, and encouraged state parties to use it very sparingly and limited, and never to use it on prisoners who have mental health issues or on youth. So, overall, I could go on and on and on. I'm not sure how much time we have, but prison is harsh, and there's a number of terrible human rights abuses that are going on.
Let's actually talk about the issue of food. So for animal rights activists who go to prison, and those activists who want to remain vegan while in prison, what is that situation and condition like for them, for those who want to remain vegan? I mean, we heard earlier in the show, of course, how prisons are sometimes, their programs for rehabilitation where they are put in as free labor in slaughterhouses. So, of course, the prison industry is well equated with and connected to the animal industry. So what are the conditions like for those who want to remain vegan in prison?
It's difficult. It's a challenge. I mean, a part of the routine of prison is that they restrict your choices, and they try to limit what you can and cannot do. So right away, I mean, choices on clothing, for example, or footwear, or anything that you want to keep on your person are limited. You may be forced to wear leather shoes, for example, or you may be forced to use products that have animal products or have been tested on animals. So that stuff almost goes out the window. And when we get to the question of diet, on paper, in most prisons, they accommodate various dietary restrictions. But when I say that, I mean they only do that on paper. So in practice, it doesn't play out quite so easily, because informally, people's things like dietary choices and lifestyle choices are used against prisoners often as forms of sort of coercion, as forms of control. So because it's viewed as a privilege, not a right, prison guards may revoke a prisoner's rights or force them to eat meat as a means of punishment, for example. Even though on paper the prison says they would accommodate a vegan diet, it may not happen in practice.
So if I can just jump in right there, we don't have that much time, but I'd really love it if you can actually chat about why prison solidarity is so important, and why those of us who actually care about animal rights and care for those animal activists who are in prison and want to remain vegan, even for those who aren't animal activists and who are in prison for other reasons, why exactly we should be doing prison solidarity, and why that kind of work is so necessary and important for prisoners.
Oh, prison solidarity is vital to maintaining the strength of our movements and reminding us all, first of all, what we're up against, because we can learn from one another, but also because people who are with the strategy of sort of destroying movements to separate and isolate activists. So when they're inside prison, and prison is an incredibly isolating and alienating place, they need to know inside that they're remembered, that they're not there for no reason, that we believe in them and we believe in what they did, and that when they come out, there's going to be a community who will embrace them and encourage them to continue fighting what they're passionate about fighting for. And so in order to sort of maintain their psychological health, their emotional health, and their hope, we need to reach out to them in prison and let them know that we're here.
So very quickly,
we're fighting too.
What are some of the ways we actually can show support for prisoners?
I think the easiest way is to write letters, and it's really easy to write letters to prisoners. A lot of animal rights activists have strong support networks who are organizing online. So if you simply Google, activists that you're aware of are in prison, or if you just Google animal rights activists in prison, you'll come up with a number of websites that will list who is in prison, what they're in prison for, and how you can write a letter to them. So that's the easiest and best way, and often prisoners will write back, and it's a great opportunity to keep our movement strong.
Great. Well, thanks so much, Sue Brown, for being with us. Very short notice, and it's fantastic to have you on the air with us. Well, best of luck today in Prison Justice Day. Hopefully a number of our listeners will be coming out, and know that I will definitely come out and see you speak. So thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks.
Okay, take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.
So again, the Prison Justice Day Memorial Rally is today, Friday, August 10th, 6 p.m. Well, there might be other events around the city, but I have a flyer here for this one. Claire Culhane Memorial Bench at Trout Lake Park, which is the south, the corner by where they sell food and the washrooms are. And so, yeah, 6 p.m. Everyone's welcome. PrisonJustice.ca. That was another informative edition of Animal Voices. We're just wrapping up here. Of course, we broadcast live every Friday from 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio CFRO in Vancouver, unceded Coast Salish Territories, Canada. Co-op Radio is completely listener-sponsored, non-commercial radio dedicated to giving a platform to marginalized groups and providing a wide array of alternative programming. If you value the critical issues we highlight on the Animal Voices show, show your support by stepping up to become a member now. Visit cooperadio.org and don't forget to mention our show. If you have any feedback or love for us, radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. Animalvoices.org is where you'll find all our past shows and videos and stuff. And Animal Voices YVR on Twitter, Animal Voices Vancouver on Facebook. Remember to tune into next week's show. Stay tuned now for Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith. He'll be featuring an artful talk by Kathleen Dean Moore about our attack on nature and the hope of reviving love. Instead, right now I'll leave you with a song by Ani DeFranco. It's called Crime for Crime. It's about capital punishment and the injustice system.
Sounding. I run my hands through my hair one last time. Outside the prison walls, town is gathering. People are trading crime for crime. Needs to see that prisoner. They need to make it even easier by seeing me as a symbol, not a human being. That way they can kill me. Say it's not murder, it's a metaphor. We are killing off our own failure and starting clean. Words to say. I'm looking out over.